Welcome to LOA Today. I'm Walt Thiessen here with life coach Cindy Chavez. Today is Wednesday, November the 20th, 2019. It's 4 p.m. New York time, and we're having all kinds of fun here trying to get onto the air, onto doing this live stream recording. Cindy, I haven't had issues like this in like a good year.
It's been
quite a while, yeah. It's just like everything decided to fall apart. Now, what did you tell me before we came on the air? What's going on right now?
Oh, Mercury is in retrograde until tomorrow, and Mercury in retrograde is famous for all kinds of technical difficulties and communication problems, and usually I kind of just, remind myself to use that period of time to revise things and edit things, but no, not start new things or try to build anything new. Mm-hmm. And usually I don't see any kind of problems, but boy, oh boy, this particular time from day one, like computer problems and all, and we've just been laughing about it because it gets to the point where it gets so ridiculous where it just doesn't stop. And we've just been laughing. And I actually had the thought today. I was like, oh, good. Tomorrow, we're at the tail end of it. We're done. We're done with this. And then this happened. I'm like, okay, Mercury has other ideas.
I guess. I was just really realizing recently that Mercury is in retrograde about half the time throughout the year. I mean, it happens
a couple times a year for a few weeks. Yeah.
I mean, there's like large chunks of the year when that happens. So I don't know if we've talked about it before, and I'm not really sure what the truth is there, but I have to admit, stuff does seem to happen. So whatever it is that I've been doing lately to focus on what I don't like, I think it's about time I change the pattern, because I don't like it so well.
I think that's why, generally speaking, it's interesting because a lot of people will give advice about it using words that start with R-E, like relax. Right? And revise. And there's a whole list of words. It's like, these are the things you should be doing. But reboot falls in there too, right? So always like, yeah, we don't want that one.
Yeah. Well, actually, I that's what I did. I rebooted the Zoom connection, hoping that would actually make a difference. So.
But did it? Because.
No.
I didn't think
so. Nope. Didn't help
at all. But we're here. We're here.
We made it. That's the most important thing.
We're here, and let's. Just fingers crossed that we stay here. No more technical difficulties.
No, it's going to be all good right now.
Yeah.
Actually, it gives us an opportunity to laugh at things, which is it's kind of part of a new thing I'm trying to do. We started it yesterday, actually, where Alex King and Dan Mangano, who's a new co-host now, and I did an entire show as a Rampage of Appreciation.
Yes.
A fun exercise. It's making me think that we want to perhaps find some way to do that on a regular basis. Not whole shows, but, like the beginning of the show or something like that. And we usually have something to laugh at or something to, kind of just get our energy up with. So it's kind of in keeping with that. So I'm sitting here saying to myself, we had all these technical difficulties. How do I turn that into an appreciation? And then it came to me instantly. I appreciate the fact that we got them ironed out enough to do the show.
Right.
It's right there.
And, when you have technical difficulties, it means that you have technology, and technology is a great
thing.
That's
right. Yeah.
Right? It's like, I always think about that when people are complaining about having to pay the electric bill and the car note or whatever. And it's like, wait, but that means that you have electricity.
Right.
I mean, we're really blessed to have all the things we have in our life, right?
Absolutely. I agree with
you. Yeah.
So it's a good reminder.
I have an appreciation. I'm ready to rampage about it.
All right. Well, good. Yeah.
All right. Yesterday was my book launch, and we went to number one in nine categories. Number one bestseller in nine categories. I'm happy.
Fantastic. Fabulous.
Yeah.
All right. Congratulations. That's really great. Where can people find out about the book?
They can order it on Amazon. It's called 365 Soulful Messages, The Right Guidance at the Right Time. And it's a whole bunch of authors that got together, and the stories are short, one page each.
Mm-hmm.
But they're stories about messages that people have gotten that changed their life.
Ah.
So it could be a story from a message that a wise person gave you, or a message that the universe gave you, or a sign or a dream or some kind of message that you got from somewhere that made a big impact in your life. And I've read a handful of the, I have one story in the book, but I've read a handful of the other stories and they're really great. So
oh, good.
Yeah. So that was fun.
So another winner. That's great. Good yeah. news. I like that. Yeah.
Thank
that's,
you.
That's always uplifting when you have something. I mean, a lot of the times we come up with uplifting stuff that's just mundane, everyday stuff. But when you have something that's a big thing like that, it's a big deal. You know?
Yeah.
That's really easy because all you have to do is just think on that and like, whew, oh, everything gets really good really quick.
Yes, it was a big deal and nice to see that the book was the fifth one in a series, mm-hmm. the last one of the series. And oh. I believe I heard that it did better than any of them. They were all bestsellers, but that it
good.
On day one did better than any of them had. So that's a nice
fabulous.
Thing to be involved in.
Yeah,
uplifting it is. Stories that are going to help people, you know, feel better.
Those are always good. They're always important. No matter what the context is, I mean, that's one of the reasons that I do the podcast, because I know it's uplifting not only to myself, but to others.
Yeah.
And that in and of itself is a positive. It's something to rampage about. So.
Yes.
Good stuff.
Yes.
Good stuff.
Good stuff.
And now, the only sad thing that's going on, by the way, is that we are nearing the end of the book.
Yes.
Law and the Promise by Neville Goddard. And so, you know, you and I, after Thanksgiving, are going to have to figure out where we're going after this.
That's right.
But what a book it's been. I mean, it's been really interesting to see how Neville's thought process evolved to the point where this was his final major work during his lifetime.
Correct.
And seeing how it all came together, I mean, certainly the themes that he outlines in the book are themes we've heard throughout all the books that we've studied so far. I guess we've done 8 of them. We counted them up last week. And I presume also it would be true of the various talks that he gave that had been recorded or either transcribed or recorded in audio. But the good news, I guess, is that it also gives us an opportunity to look at and listen to some of those others and make those part of our ongoing Neville conversation. So,
right. And, you know, in the last month, we've gotten a couple of messages that were similar. One message was somebody who actually loves Neville Day and I believe sent us the title of another book that you were waiting on.
And I just got a notification from the library that it arrived, so I have to go pick it up.
Excellent. And then the other one was somebody that said, on the sad day when you finally finish all the Neville books, maybe you can either read Neville lectures or read a similar book. And it was funny because we had just gotten a suggestion about a book that someone thought was similar to Neville's processes, which neither one of us have read yet. So we're not sure where we're going with that. But I thought, okay, our audience, our listeners are actually like giving us direction, right?
See, that's when you know that you're a success. Yeah. When your audience members are saying, hey, go here. You
right?
know you're on the right track.
So I think that's kind of exciting. I'm interested in that book, and I need to read it, too, so we can see what we think about it. But
we'll
figure out a place to go. We will have to figure out.
I don't think there's any doubt about that. And, you know, even if it gets to the point, and I'm sure we will eventually get to this point, where we've done all the books, all the lectures, all the audio tapes, everything that Neville had published, I'd be willing to bet that there's someplace else for us to go at that point with Neville.
Well, I do, too, what I think is interesting, especially with Neville, but I have done it with other books, is reading them a second time.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. it's so different, right? Because when you read it the next time, you're different because you've learned something. And things will stand out to you that didn't stand out to you before. And I think that would be even something we could consider is rereading one and seeing how different it is.
I threatened one time in the past to actually, as we're going through these books, write out the Neville decoder ring, you know, and make like an actual yes. glossary of terms and so forth.
We did talk about that.
We did, yeah. I never did
That'd
follow
be a good
through.
Idea.
Maybe we end up doing that. Who knows?
Well, we're on chapter 15. Do we have any announcements we want to make before we start?
Oh, just the usual ones, which have, by the way, been doing a very effective job of helping to promote the show.
Excellent.
So, first of all, I want to thank all of our most recent new subscribers to the show for becoming subscribers. And the reason we know that you're there, you never really actually know when someone becomes a subscriber because there's no actual way to track that. Mm-hmm. But you can tell kind of vicariously by seeing how listenership increases. And listenership has been really taking off. I mentioned that over a few shows, but lately it really has been. It's one of those things that you can't instantly say, well, this week it's up 30% compared to last week because there are fluctuations. So you have to kind of iron those fluctuations out. So I look at it over the course of a month. What happens after shows have been published for a month? And I track those numbers. And when I look at what's been going on with those numbers, we're up probably about 30 to 40% over the last 3 months.
Wow.
That's a big increase.
Yeah.
That's a really big increase. Well, in fact...
We've been visioning it, right? So
we have.
All of the things we've been picturing, you know, for the past couple of years are starting to get some momentum.
So all those people who recently became subscribers, we're talking to you saying thank you very much for listening to the message. And the message was really simple. Become a subscriber. It's very simple. Just go to the homepage of our website if you're not yet a subscriber, loatoday.net, and right at the top of the page you'll see very simple instructions. Dan Mangano informs me that it takes one click. I think it actually takes two, but I won't dispute him.
Pretty easy.
Very, very easy. And once you do that, you are subscribed, and all of our episodes come streaming right to your smartphone as they are published. So, you know, be sure to keep up with everything that way. And by the way, interesting thing, this month we have had, I think, 4 shows we had to cancel for various reasons.
Wow. Yeah.
And despite those, now in the past, cancellations like that would have taken a hit in terms of the overall number of listeners per month and all that kind of thing. Not so this month. This month, despite the fact that we missed 4 episodes, our listenership is actually higher than it was last month so far. Now we're only about halfway through the month, about 2/3 of the way through the month. But even so, I figure that's pretty darn good. I mean, we're on track to a better month.
You said four shows canceled. I'm glad it wasn't 5. You know, after today, I was like, not sure what's happening here, but
there's going to be more because we have Thanksgiving coming up. So
that's right.
There won't be any show on Thanksgiving. You won't be able to make a Wednesday show. Linda won't be able to make a Friday show. I'm thinking about maybe trying to bring somebody else, maybe a couple people, in to do a Wednesday show as sort of a celebration of Thanksgiving. But we're going to miss at least 2 shows that week, maybe 3. Right. You know, so does that mean that the listenership goes up another 20%? I mean, I don't know.
It's going to go up, yes. The paradox. We're like, I don't know. I have a friend that is a master at conscious creation, and she has one thing she says, it's like, the more fun I have, the more money I make.
So I like that. I like that one, yeah.
So you never know, you know. All right, well, if we're ready to dive in.
Dive into the very last chapter of the Law and the Promise.
Very last chapter.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is that this chapter is called The Promise. And the book is called The Law and the Promise. And we've had lots of chapter titles, but this last chapter is called The Promise. And the subtitle of the chapter is called 4 Mystical Experiences. So I'm not sure what we're in for here. I think it's going to be interesting.
I'm sure.
So we start with, in all I've related thus far, with the exception of GB's vision of the child, imagination was consciously exercised. Men and women created stage plays in their imagination, plays implying the fulfillment of their desires. Then, by imagining themselves participating in these dramas, they created that which their imaginal acts implied. This is the wise use of God's law. But, quote, no man is justified before God by the law. Many people are interested in imaginism as a way of life, but are not at all interested in its framework of faith, a faith leading to the fulfillment of God's promise. Then he quotes from 2 Samuel, I will raise up your son after you, who shall come forth from your body. I will be his father, and he shall be my son. Now remember, this is important that we kind of think about Neville's decoder ring, because everything, whenever Neville quotes from the Bible, any Bible, any scripture, he's always using it metaphorically. So when he says the son and the father, he's talking about your imagination and the fruits of your imagination.
In fact, he previously was specifically talking about consciousness and the subconscious.
Yes, true. So it's important to remember that so that his explanation makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
He says the promise that God will bring forth from our body a son who will be born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God, does not concern them. They want to know God's law, not his promise. However, this miraculous birth has been stated clearly as a must for all mankind from the earliest days of the Christian fellowship. You must be born from above, John 3:7. My purpose here is to state it again and to state it in such language and with such reference to my own personal mystical experiences that the reader will see that this birth from above is far more than a part of a dispensable superstructure. That is, it is the sole purpose for God's creation. Specifically, my purpose in recording these four mystical experiences is to show what Jesus Christ, the faithful witness, the firstborn from the dead, was trying to say about this birth from above. And he quotes, "How can men preach unless they are sent?" So I believe he's going to start telling us about the first mystical experience he had.
I can hardly wait.
He says, "Many years ago, I was taken in spirit into a divine society, a society of men in whom God is awake. Though it may seem strange, the gods do truly meet. As I entered this society, the first to greet me was the embodiment of infinite might. His was a power unknown to mortals. I was then taken to meet infinite love. He asked me, 'What is the greatest thing in the world?' I answered him in the words of Paul, 'Faith, hope, and love, these three, but the greatest of these is love.' At that moment, he embraced me, and our bodies fused and became one body. I was knit to him and loved him as my own soul. The words 'love of God,' so often a mere phrase, were now a reality with tremendous meaning. Nothing ever imagined by man could be compared with this love which man feels through his union with love. The most intimate relationship on earth is like living in separate cells compared with this union. While I was in this state of supreme delight, a voice from outer space shouted, 'Down with the blue bloods.' At this blast, I found myself standing before the one who had first greeted me, who embodied infinite might. He looked into my eyes, and without the use of words or mouth, I heard what he told me: 'Time to act.' I was suddenly whisked out of that divine society and returned to earth. I was tormented by my limitations of understanding, but I knew that on that day, the divine society had chosen me as a companion and sent me to preach Christ, God's promise to man." Any thoughts so far?
It's confusing and interesting all at the same time.
A voice from outer space.
Okay. I think I'm reserving my response until I find out what the heck is he talking about.
Okay, let's keep going. My mystical experiences have brought me to accept literally the saying that all the world's a stage, and to believe that God plays all the parts. The purpose of the play? To transform man, the created, into God, the creator. God loved man, his created, and became man in faith that this act of self-commission would transform man, the created, into God, the creator. The play begins with the crucifixion of God on man, as man, and ends with the resurrection of man as God. God becomes as we are, that we may be as he is. God becomes man, that man may become first a living being, and secondly, a life-giving spirit. And then he quotes Galatians from the Christian Bible. I have been crucified with Christ. It's no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And the life I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. Now, this is interesting coming up here because he says God took upon himself the form of man and became obedient unto death, even death on the cross of man, and is crucified on Golgotha, the skull of man. God himself enters death's door, the human skull, and lies down in the grave of man to make man a living being. God's mercy turned death into sleep. Then began the prodigious and unthinkable metamorphosis of man, the transformation of man into God. No man, unaided by the crucifixion of God, could cross the threshold that admits to conscious life. But now we have union with God in his crucified self. He lives in us as our wonderful human imagination. man is all imagination, and God is man, and exists in us, and we in him. The eternal body of man is the imagination, that is God himself. Now, here's what I find interesting about this, is that Neville has told us many times that he does not believe the Christian Bible to be historical record.
True.
But a psychological drama.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm trying to look at what he's saying here as that, and recognizing that Neville has said over and over that he doesn't believe it's literal.
Right.
So when he talks about God becoming man and being crucified on a cross, most Christians would believe that that's literal, that that's right. History, that that mm-hmm. happened, that an actual human being was God and was crucified. So I think it's interesting that we know that Neville doesn't buy that.
I have a question that I can't remember the answer to, and I'm curious if you remember the answer to. Has Neville previously used the metaphorical image of crucifixion in his writings? I can't remember
that
he did.
Not often. That's what I want to say. Not often. If he has, it hasn't been a current theme. Now, there are a couple books we haven't read.
True.
And we actually, we haven't read them. We didn't choose them first for the particular reason that we thought they were going to have many, many, many references to the Christian Bible. We were mm-hmm. like, well, I don't know if we're ready to do that yet. It's not a belief system that either one of us hold.
Right.
So, but I don't believe that Neville did either in a literal sense. And so it's very mm-hmm. interesting that he's talking about it.
That's why I think this word crucifixion is such an important word in this. And I'll be curious to see if he provides clarity about it. Because
right.
he has a long track record of providing clarity about key concepts that are biblically, religiously related concepts that he has held, like you pointed out, over and over again to be actually part of a great psychological drama.
Right.
I just have this really deep belief and feeling that crucifixion is one of those concepts. It's like it's a missing piece.
So, you know, after all that discussion, he then quotes Blake saying the eternal body of man is the imagination, that is God himself. And this is what he said all along, is that God is our imagination.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He says, when he rises in us, we will be like him and he will be like us. Then all impossibilities will dissolve in us at that touch of exaltation, which his rising in us will impart to our nature. Here's the secret of the world. God died to give man life and to set man free. For however clearly God is aware of his creation, it does not follow that man, imaginatively created, is aware of God. To work this miracle, God had to die, then rise again as man, and none has ever expressed it so clearly as William Blake. Blake says, or rather has Jesus say, unless I die, thou canst not live, but if I die, I shall arise again, and thou with me. Wouldst thou love one who had never died for thee, or ever die for one who had not died for thee? And if God dieth not for man, and giveth not himself eternally for man, man could not exist. So God dies. That is to say, God has freely given himself for man, deliberately. He has become man and has forgotten that he is God in the hope that man, thus created, will eventually rise as God. God has so completely offered his own self for man that he cries out on the cross of man, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? He has completely forgotten that he is God. But after God rises in one man, that man will say to his brothers, why stand we here trembling around, calling on God for help, and not ourself, in who God dwells? This first man that has been raised from the dead is known as Jesus Christ, the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep, the firstborn of the dead. For man, God died. Now, by a man, has come also the resurrection of the dead. Jesus Christ resurrects his dead father by becoming his father. In Adam, the universal man, God sleeps. In Jesus Christ, the individualized God, God wakes. In waking, man, the created, has become God. the Creator, and can truly say, before the world was, I am. Just as God in his love for man so completely identified himself with man that he forgot he was God, so man in his love for God must so completely identify himself with God that he lives the life of God. That is, imaginatively. God's play, which transforms man into God, is revealed to us in the Bible. Any thoughts?
It is becoming more and more clear that we need more clarity. I can say that I think we're on the right track with asking the question, what is the metaphorical meaning of crucifixion? Because he then goes into a more specific focus, God dying, the idea of God dying, mm-hmm. death playing a role here. And the death, he is suggesting fairly strongly, is a death of awareness of oneself being God. So I can sense that he's starting to pull concepts together here. I'm still looking for him to define terms a little bit more. So I'm saying to myself, withhold judgment, wait until you hear what it is that it all adds up to, and then let's see if we can make sense out of it.
Okay. So he says it's completely consistent in imagery and symbolism. Speaking of the Christian Bible. He says the New Testament is hid in the Old Testament, and the old is manifested in the new. The Bible is a vision of God's law and his promise. So I'm just going to make a short disclaimer here personally. And that is with the idea, you often hear me refer to the Jewish Bible and the Christian Bible instead of the Old Testament and the New Testament. Mm-hmm. And that is because, even when Jesus walked on the planet, if he actually did, in the stories that we hear of him, his Bible would have been what Christians call the Old Testament. And there was never any idea that there needed to be anything new added. So it didn't get, the new part didn't get added until 400 years after Jesus was gone.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. So to many people that read that Bible, that's the complete Bible for them. They don't need what the Christians call the New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
Just pointing that out. Because Neville is talking about it as one whole. So I'm taking that he took it all together.
Well, there's also a very specific statement here. And I suspect that you're probably on a good track for understanding it. He says the New Testament is hid in the Old Testament. I mean, that the idea of the New Testament already being in the Old Testament is, first of all, it's a rather revolutionary thought. I mean, it does fit in with traditional religious iconography and teaching and the way these stories are traditionally presented within Christian churches. But so in that sense, that's an understandable phrase. But from what we might call a literature review perspective, the idea of the New Testament being hidden in the Old Testament, that's a pretty radical thought, because the stories of the New Testament, they have certain shadows, certain reflections in the Old Testament, but they're really unique to themselves. So I'm curious to know, what's Neville saying about that? Because you said, there are these two different ideas of what the Bible's about.
Right. And it's interesting. He says it was never intended to teach history. This is mm-hmm. what we were saying before, because Neville says this all the time. Right. It was never intended to teach history, but rather to lead man in faith through the furnaces of affliction to the fulfillment of God's promise, to rouse man from this profound sleep and awaken him as God. Its characters live not in the past, but in an imaginative eternity. They are personifications of the eternal spiritual states of the soul. They mark man's journey through eternal death and his awakening to eternal life. The Old Testament tells us of God's promise. The New Testament tells us not how this promise was fulfilled, but how it is fulfilled. The central theme of the Bible is the direct, individual, mystical experience of the birth of the child, that child of whom the prophet spoke. To us, a child is born. To us, a son is given. And the government will be upon his shoulder, and his name will be called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and of peace, there will be no end. Isaiah 9:6 and 7. When the child is revealed to us, we see it, we experience it. And the response to this revelation can be stated in the words of Job. I have heard of thee by the hearing of the ear, but now my eyes see thee. The story of the incarnation is not fable, allegory, or some carefully contrived fiction to enslave the minds of men, but mystical fact. It is a personal, mystical experience of the birth of oneself out of one's own skull, symbolized in the birth of a child wrapped in swaddling clothes and lying on the floor. There is a distinction between hearing of this birth of a child from one's own skull, a birth which no scientist or historian could ever possibly explain, and actually experiencing the birth, holding in your own hands and seeing with your own eyes this miraculous child, a child born from above out of your own skull, a birth contrary to all the laws of nature. The question, as it is posed in the Old Testament, ask now and see, can a male bear a child? Why then do I see every man with his hands delivering himself like a woman in labor? Why has every face turned pale? Jeremiah 36. The Hebrew word chalatz, mistranslated loins, means to draw out, to deliver, to withdraw self. The drawing of oneself out of one's own skull was exactly what the prophet foresaw as the necessary birth from above, a birth giving man entrance into the kingdom of God and reflective perception on the highest levels of being. Throughout the ages, deep calls to deep. Rouse thyself. Why sleepest thou, Lord? Awake. The event, as it is recorded in the Gospels, actually takes place in man. But of that day or that hour when the time will come for the individual to be delivered, no one knows but the Father. Do not marvel that I said to you, you must be born from above. The wind blows where it wills, and you hear the sound of it, but you do not know whence it comes or whither it goes. So it is with everyone who is born of the Spirit. So just a couple thoughts here. It's very, very interesting because what it sounds like Neville's saying here to me is that this birth that he's talking about, a man being birthed from his own skull, is us recognizing our creative power and becoming becoming God, as he says, and recognizing that that power is imaginative. Mm-hmm. I think that that's the skull reference.
No doubt about that. Yeah, I agree with that. Okay. Yeah.
Let's see. I lost my place. Okay. Who before the experience could believe that the child, the wonderful counselor, the mighty God, the everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace, was inwoven in his own skull? Who before the experience would understand that his maker is his husband and the Lord of hosts is his name? Who would believe that the Creator went in unto his own creation, man, and knew it to be himself, and that this entrance into the skull of man, this union of God and man, resulted in the birth of a son out of the skull of man, which birth gave to that man eternal life and union with his Creator forever? If I now tell what I experienced that night, I do so not to impose my ideas on others, but that I may give hope to those who, like Nicodemus, wonder, how can a man be born when he is old? How can he enter a second time into his mother's womb and be born? How can this be? This is how it happened to me. Therefore, I will now write the vision and make it plain upon the tablet so he may run who reads it. For the vision still awaits its time. It hastens to the end. It will not lie. If it seems slow, wait for it. It will surely come. It will not delay. Behold, he whose soul is not upright in him shall fail, but the righteous shall live by faith. So this must be mystical experience two, the second one.
Well, also that one line is one I really identify with because it pretty much summarizes what I'm doing right now as Neville's telling the story. It says, if it seems slow, wait for it. It will surely come. It will not delay. I'm waiting.
Wait for it. Wait for it. That's what we say with Neville a lot. And you are right, though. He generally does make it clear. I think this is really interesting, though, the idea that, you know, what I think is funny is Neville goes, this isn't an allegory, but it's definitely, you know, an allegory, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I think what he means by that is this isn't just some, you know, allegory that we're talking about. Like, this is something that he wants us to experience.
Mm-hmm.
So he says over and over, like, until you experience this.
Yeah. And that's something
you understand it.
Anybody who's ever spoken with anybody else, or even experienced for themselves, an experience that one might call out of body, or
right.
mystical, or spiritual, or psychic, or mediumship, or whatever. When the person who experienced it is done, the first thing that goes through their mind is, what was that? What did I just experience? How on earth could I possibly explain that to anybody else? That's right. The feeling he's talking about.
Yeah, and then the second thought is like, nobody's going to believe me.
Nobody's going to believe me, right?
So, okay, so here we go. He says, in the early hours of the morning on July 20th, 1959, in the city of San Francisco, a heavenly dream in which the arts flourished was suddenly interrupted by the most intense vibration centered at the base of my skull. Then, a drama as real as those I experience when I am fully awake began to unfold. I awoke from a dream to find myself completely entombed within my skull. I tried to force my way out through its base. Something gave away, and I felt myself move head downward through the base of my skull. I squeezed myself out inch by inch. When I was almost out, I held what I took to be the foot of the bed and pulled the remaining portion of me out of my skull. There, on the floor, I lay for a few seconds. Then I rose and looked at my body on the bed. It was pale of face, lying on its back, and tossing from side to side like one in recovery from a great ordeal. As I contemplated it, hoping that it would not fall off the bed, I became aware that the vibration which started the whole drama was not only in my head, but now was also coming from the corner of the room. As I looked over to that corner, I wondered if that vibration could be caused by a very high wind. A wind strong enough to vibrate the window. I did not realize that the vibration, which I still felt within my head, was related to that which seemed to be coming from the corner of the room. Looking back to the bed, I discovered that my body was gone, but in its place sat my three older brothers. My oldest brother sat where the head was. My second and third brothers sat where the feet were. None seemed to be aware of me, although I was aware of them. And could discern their thoughts. I suddenly became aware of the reality of my own invisibility. I noticed that they too were disturbed by the vibration coming from the corner of the room. My third brother was the most disturbed and went over to investigate the cause of the disturbance. His attention was attracted by something on the floor, and looking down, he announced, "It's Neville's baby." My other two brothers, in most incredulous voices, asked, "How can Neville have a baby?" My brother lifted the infant, wrapped in swaddling clothes, and laid him on the bed. I, then, with my invisible hands, lifted the babe and asked him, "How is my sweetheart?" He looked into my eyes and smiled, and I awoke in this world to ponder this greatest of my many mystical experiences. Wow. Wow.
So he has a dream that essentially plays out his version of the drama of the Immaculate Conception and birth.
Right. And of the questions, you know, how can a man give birth to himself?
Right.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He says Tennyson has a description of death as a warrior, a skeleton high on a night black horse issuing forth at midnight. But when Gareth's sword cut through the skull, there was in it the bright face of a blooming boy, fresh as a flower, newborn. Two other visions I will tell, because they bear out the truth of my assertion that the Bible is mystical fact, that everything written about the promised child in the law of Moses and the prophets and the Psalms must be mystically experienced in the imagination of the individual. There's your clarity right there, right?
Some. Let's come back to it. Yeah. I mean, unless you want to talk about it right now, but I'm curious to see where he's going with it.
Yeah, I am too. Just making that note, there's the clarity of what he's going to say.
Okay.
Child's birth is a sign and a portent, signaling the resurrection of David, the Lord's anointed, of whom he said, "You are my son, today I've begotten you." 5 months after the birth of the child, the vision, I imagine, right?
Right.
Neville's baby. 5 months later, on the morning of December 6th, 1959, in the city of Los Angeles, a vibration similar to the one which preceded his birth started in my head. This time, its intensity was centered around the top of my head. Then came a sudden explosion, and I found myself in a modestly furnished room. There, leaning against the side of an open door, was my son David of biblical fame. He was a lad in his early teens. What struck me forcibly about him was the unusual beauty of his face and figure. He was, as he is described in the book of, in the first book of Samuel, ruddy with beautiful eyes and very handsome. Not for one moment did I feel myself to be anyone other than who I am now. Yet I knew that this lad, David, was my son, and he knew that I was his father. For, quote, the wisdom from above is without uncertainty. As I sat there, contemplating the beauty of my son, the vision faded and I awoke. And then he quotes, I and the children whom the Lord has given me are signs and portents in Israel from the Lord of hosts who dwells on Mount Zion. God gave me David as my very own son. I will raise up your son after you, who shall come forth from your body. I will be his father, and he will be my son. God is known in no other way than through the Son. No one knows who the Son is except the Father, or who the Father is except the Son, and anyone to whom the Son chooses to reveal him. The experience of being David's father is the end of man's pilgrimage on earth. The purpose of life is to find the Father of David, the Lord's anointed, the Christ. Abner, whose son is this youth? And Abner said, as your soul lives, O king, I cannot tell. And the king said, inquire whose son the stripling is. And David returned from the slaughter of the Philistine. Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine in his hand. And Saul said to him, whose son are you, young man? And David answered, I am the son of your servant Jesse the Bethlehemite. Jesse is any form of the verb to be. In other words, I am the son of who I am. I am self-begotten. I am the son of God, the Father. I and my Father are one. I am the image of the invisible God. He who has seen me has seen the Father. Whose son, question mark, is not about David, but about David's father, whom the king had promised to make free in Israel. Note, in all these passages, the king's inquiry is not about David, but about David's father. I have found David my servant. He shall cry to me, thou art my father, my God, the rock of my salvation, and I will make him the firstborn, the highest of the kings of the earth. The individual who is born from above will find David and know him to be his very own son. Then he will ask the Pharisees, who are always with us, what do you think of the Christ? Whose son is he? And when they say to him, the son of David, he will say to them, how is it then that David, in the Spirit, calls him Lord? If David thus calls him Lord, how is he his son? Man's misconception of the role of the son, which is only a sign and a portent, has made the son an idol. Little children, keep yourselves from idols. God awakes, and that man in whom he awakes becomes his own father's father. He who is David's son, Jesus Christ, the son of David, has become David's father. No longer will I cry to our father David, thy child. I have found David. He has cried to me, thou art my father. Now I know myself to be one of the Elohim, the God who became man, that man may become God. Great indeed, we confess, is the mystery of our religion. If the Bible were history, it would not be a mystery. Wait for the promise of the Father, that is, for David, God's son, who will reveal you as the Father. The promise, says Jesus, you heard from me, and to its fulfillment at that moment in time when it pleases God to give you his son as your offspring, which is Christ. A figure of speech is used for the purpose of calling attention to, emphasizing, and intensifying the reality of the literal sense. The truth is literal. The words used are figurative. The curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom, and the earth shook and the rocks were split. On the morning of April 8, 1960, 4 months after it was revealed to me that I am David's father, a bolt of lightning out of my skull split me in two from the top of my skull to the base of my spine. I was cleft as though I were a tree that had been struck by lightning. Then I felt and saw myself as a golden liquid light moving up my spine in a serpentine motion. As I entered my skull, it vibrated like an earthquake. Every word of God proves true. He is a shield to those who take refuge in him. Do not add to his words, lest he rebuke you and you be found a liar. And as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so must the Son of Man be lifted up. These mystical experiences will help to rescue the Bible from the externals of history, persons, and events, and to restore it to its real significance in the life of man. Scripture must be fulfilled in us. God's promise will be fulfilled. You will have these experiences, and you shall be my witnesses in Jerusalem and all Judea and Samaria and to the end of the earth. The widening circle, Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, the end of the earth, is God's plan. The promise is still maturing to its time, its appointed time. But how long, vast, and severe the trials are you find David, your son, who will reveal you as God, the Father, were long to tell. But it hastens to the end. It will not fail. So wait, for there will be no postponement. Is anything too wonderful for the Lord? At the appointed time, I will return to you in the spring, and Sarah shall have a son. The end, it says.
Okay. Well, let's go back to that section that we said, okay, this is where he made it clear. And I'm going to start by asking you, because you're the one who made that point, so what do you think clarified in that sentence? It was a statement that began, two other visions I will tell you because they bear out the truth of my assertion that the Bible is mystical fact. That everything...
Because he says, two other visions I'll tell because they bear out the truth of my assertion that... the Bible is a mystical fact, and that everything written about the promised child in the law of Moses and the prophets and the Psalms must be mystically experienced in the imagination of the individual. And to me, that made it very clear what he was saying here. I mean, I don't know that I can make it any clearer than he made it. He's just saying, here's what I'm telling you. I'm telling you that anything written in the Bible, and he is saying, the Old Testament, the law, Moses and the prophets and the Psalms, that is considered the Tanakh, the Old Testament, what the Christians call the Old Testament.
Right.
He says anything in there has to be mystically experienced in the imagination of the individual. And I'm like, okay, here's his statement. Here's his mission statement, right? It's like, wherever you see this, Neville is saying, it didn't get fulfilled in history. It has to be fulfilled in you, in your imagination. And the idea where he talks about recognizing that, you know, that you are David's father, in other words, is just another way of him saying you are going to recognize that you are God.
Okay. The parts that are still not clear to me, and I'm not sure if we're going to find clarity yet, we may have to look into those other books that we mentioned and maybe look into some of these other lectures, are what the exact role of crucifixion and death are in this, it's not allegorical, it's a metaphorical drama that he's presented here. It's kind of an explication of what he's talked about all along, that all of the Bible is a drama, a psychological drama being played out to explain the true role of I, myself, my consciousness, my ability to create.
I can tell you what I think he's saying there, and I liken it to the idea that the old version of us, the version that's not able to consciously create, the version that doesn't recognize that we have that power, has to die in order for the new version of us, which is the version that does recognize we have that power, to live.
And so the question that enters my mind is, what does that mean to die? Because again, this is metaphorical rather than a physical death. So what does that mean? What does it mean to die like that?
Well, I tell you, you know, we could go into a very deep discussion about life in general and about, you know, in astrology, the season that we're in right now, Scorpio season, talks a lot about the underworld and about Plutonic initiation, which is those times in our life when we feel like we've just been pitched into the depths of hell, right? And that, and usually we also feel like we're never going to be able to get out of there. Mm-hmm. What ends up happening is that, of course, we do come out. And right. If we look at mythology, there are lots and lots of myths where the person in the myth is thrown into the pit of hell, like Persephone, right? And down there, she goes through what she goes through, but she rises up again as somebody who's been reborn and somebody now who has the power. And so we see that in the story of Jesus, right? Jesus was crucified and went into the depths of hell for 3 days, and then he was resurrected and he came forth as a different being, mm-hmm. A being that was powerful. And so that's the story over and over and over. We see the story in all kinds of mythology.
True.
And I think what Neville's saying is that this has to be recognized in us. Now, I don't know what he's talking about. Like, you asked the question, what is the crucifixion? I don't know. With Neville, it may not be quite the same as what other mythologies give us. I'm not sure.
I would be willing to bet that it's not, actually. Right. Because that would be par for the Neville course.
Right. Right, exactly. Plus, I can't picture Neville saying, but he might, talking about being plunged into hell and having to go through something most of us don't want to go through.
Mm-hmm.
But when I look at humanity and I look at my own life and people that I know, most people do go through things like that in life.
True.
And hopefully not more than once, but, we do. We go through things that are the dark night of the soul. I mean, that's, that's part of it. So
the metaphorical description, which he also presented as a dream state or a dream experience of the skull vibrating, mm-hmm. The production of an actual baby in the corner who is the baby of Neville,
right?
The experience of flowing himself out through the stem of his skull. I mean, all of these storylines, he tells them in a way that basically says to me, this is the way it seemed to be that I experienced it. It does not seem to me, he's saying, this is telling you literally how everything works.
So I think we
can be assured of the fact this is not a literal presentation, even though I've heard a lot of people who style themselves as Neville experts claim that, yes, it is a literal thing.
No, yeah. I believe this was possibly a lucid dream.
Mm-hmm.
A dream within a dream, and also all of the talk about hard vibration in the brainstem makes me think of something neurological, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He then talks about the sense of a golden liquid or something that's moving up his spine like a serpent.
Right.
That is like a picture of Kundalini energy, like mm-hmm. you will read about in some other belief systems.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a lot of that is. It was his individual experience. And he even says at one point, like, I'm not telling you this because I think you have to go experience this exact same thing. I'm just telling you what I experienced because it was my experience. So
that first,
really powerful.
It is. That first
dream is just blowing my mind.
It does, doesn't it? It really does.
Yeah.
That paragraph that we highlighted that we came back to discuss starts off with an interesting little two-word phrase in it. I'll reread the first sentence. It says, two other visions I will tell because they bear out the truth of my assertion that the Bible is, here it is, mystical fact.
Yes.
And the reason I highlight mystical fact is I've heard a lot of Neville, again, self-described experts, talking about mystical fact and emphasizing it and saying, yes, all of these stories that he tells are true mystical fact. And I say that because my sense is there are a lot of people who like to blur boundaries, and not that there are necessarily true boundaries, but boundaries in understanding is probably the better way to say it. Blurring boundaries of understanding between what is presented metaphorically and what happens in the real world. The real world being, of course, something we created. And this all starts to kind of become chicken and egg where, okay, so where's all this starting? Where's all this ending? Where's all this coming together? What's the real flow of energy going on here and so forth? But nevertheless, I keep coming back to the same idea over and over again. There's a blurring and a blending of boundaries going on. And I doubt, this is me expressing a personal opinion, I doubt that blurring of boundaries actually occurred in Neville's mind. I don't think Neville was blurring boundaries, but I can't prove that.
No, and I think we look at the word fact and realize that the modifier is mystical.
Yes.
Then it sounds to me that at that point, it's the fact of the individual's experience.
Yes.
Because mystical things, he's already told us that it's an experience, and that how can somebody understand it unless they've experienced? So I think that Neville is saying that his experiences were fact. They happened, and that the Bible is full of mystical fact.
Mm-hmm.
Like, but it has to be experienced, the things he's talking about. Yeah. That's how I'm weaving it all together anyway.
And that would make sense. It fits everything that I know, and I will leave it to you to tell me whether it fits everything you know about mystical experiences that we've heard from other sources, people that we know, people we've read, people we've seen mm-hmm. movies and videos on, and so forth, where in every case, the mystical experience, or however you want to describe it, the experience, the extraordinary experiences they related were their own experiences.
Yeah.
They weren't claiming it. This is the way everybody experiences it. In fact, right. many people go out of their way to say, no, this is not necessarily the way other people experience it.
Right.
They have similar things that they experience, but they don't necessarily experience the dream I just had, because that was for me. That was my dream.
Right.
Yeah.
And it was generated by you and by your imagination and by your past experiences in this life, and maybe past life experiences. I don't know. But
could be.
They're all generated by what you know.
Mm-hmm.
So if you talk to a Christian who's had a near-death experience, they often reference, you know, Jesus and angels and things that fall into their belief system. But if you talk to someone from a different religion, they may have an out-of-body experience or a near-death experience and be with Ganesha or somebody that's to their, you know, knowledge. So
right.
it's all us. It's happening in our head, like everything else is happening in our head.
So I'm inclined to continue. Well, what was the phrase that Neville used? I don't know if I can find it quickly, but the gist of it was to wait for it. We talked about that before. We took out of wait
yes.
for it. I'm actually going to continue to wait for it, because we already alluded to the fact that there are two books we have not talked about, we have not read, we have not studied in this course, if you will, that we've done here on the LOA today.
Right.
And we did so probably because they were so heavily laden with biblical verse. Well, I think we've gotten enough education about Neville to dive into those. So after the Thanksgiving holiday, let's go do those.
All right.
And let's do that with a kind of keeping in mind what's in the latter half of this chapter, because the latter half of this chapter is loaded with a mixture of biblical verse. And every time in the past that Neville has told a story where he included some degree of biblical verse, it was to weave it into an overall story that he was trying to tell that was different from the way the Christian churches tell their stories from the Bible. He had a very specific story in mind. The way this story is structured, I think, kind of calls out for, where's the rest of the decoder ring? Where is the rest of the illusions? I think we need to figure those out if we're going to really come to grips with what he's saying.
Okay, I'm up to the challenge.
Does that sound good to you?
Yeah. Let's do it.
I really believe it's going to make a difference. I just, everything that Neville has told us, you and I, as we've been studying his stuff, has been so consistent. That's the thing that strikes me. It's so completely consistent. And so many of his allusions are to consciousness and to imagination and to the processes of the mind.
Everything. That's everything.
Yeah. So when I hear him now going off into what, now I admit, and I think you admit too, I have a bias against Christian organized religion. My bias dates back to when I was 14 years old. I've told that story before. So I recognize I definitely have a bias, but that bias also gives me the ability to look completely and fully at what's being expressed to me in that terminology, not to just kind of blanket accept it on face value without giving it any thought.
Right. And especially when it's coming from Neville.
Yeah. So to me, this is going to be a good exploration, just to find out, can we fill in the gaps to really understand what's he actually saying here?
Because
I think we got it partly. I mean, this is certainly a continuation of consciousness and imagination, and we our consciousness is God, and the role of God, Son of God, Jesus, the whole thing, all of that. We've gone over that over and over and over again in his prior writings, and it's bearing out here. But there's more. I can tell there's more here that we just haven't quite gotten, and I'll even project the idea, and I don't know this for sure, but I'm going to put it out there as a speculative hypothesis. This was Neville's last book. I'm wondering if Neville didn't finish it. I'm wondering if he had more to say and he just never got there. Because this was published, it was published a little less than a decade before he passed.
Right.
But he never did any extensive writing of this kind after that. And he'd been writing continuously throughout his life as a presenter of these ideas from the 1930s onward. Why stop?
It's a good question.
It's like there's a part of the story that I get the feeling he wanted to tell more of. So let's see if that's true.
Let's do it.
All right.
We'll come back after Thanksgiving and we'll dive in.
So once again, thank you so much for helping to guide us through all this and share your insights. And I don't know if I've said this in the past enough, but I really love how with both of us, we go into this, yes, we have our own personal biases, but we go into this with an open mind, and we go into this with the idea of, I want to understand what Neville's telling, because he's drawn us in successfully, you know?
Absolutely.
And I like that so much. So thank you for helping us to do that. I really appreciate that.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Thank you to our live streamers, and thank you especially to our podcast listeners who are loving this more and more. They're giving us more and more thumbs up. How are they doing that? By listening to more and more episodes of the Neville Day, the Wednesday is Neville Day recordings. We're getting those numbers are also increasing proportionate to where they were before. It used to be Neville listeners were a smaller percentage of the overall. Now they've actually gotten to be a very significant share. So thank you to Neville listeners as well.
Thank you.
We will wish everybody a happy Thanksgiving, because Cindy, I won't be talking to you until after the Thanksgiving holiday. So I hope you and your family have a great Thanksgiving.
Thank you, and all of you as well.
And we will see you all next time here on LOA Today. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye, everyone.